Hi everyone, I'm Danny Chambers. I'm the I founded Vet Voices, and this is our Vet Voices podcast. And I'm here with Dan Tipney from VetLed, which many of you will have heard of. And Dan, would you like to tell us about VetLed and what you try and do?
Absolutely. Thanks, Danny. Thanks for having me. So, VetLed, we're an organization. We provide training and support to veterinary teams, to organizations, to individuals, and we do it in a number of ways. And it's all based around a series of non-clinical subjects, as I said, based around the field of human factors. So we deliver workshops and we do training, we do coaching, we kind of go in and do more sort of consultancy work sometimes. Sometimes we run observations within practice teams, sort of fly on the wall type sort of sessions. We run an annual patient safety summit and an annual human factors conference. So we have lots of different methods by which we deliver this support. But as I said, it's based around this field of human factors. And I know we'll get a chance to talk a bit more about that in a second. But for me, in a nutshell, human factors is the field that sort of metaphorically joins or bridges the gap between knowing what you're doing at a technical level. So for many people in the vet profession, that's clinical skills and knowledge. It's everything that bridges the gap between those technical or clinical skills and the outcomes you want to achieve. So I must imagine them in two hands. On the left hand, you've kind of got your technical, your clinical skills. On the other hand, you've got the outcomes you want to achieve. For many people, that's for patients, but of course, there are lots of other outcomes as well that matter. And for me, human factors are all the things, all the considerations, all the disciplines that enable individuals and teams and organizations to reliably deliver those skills.
This is
In a
really
nutshell.
interesting. So it's to sort of bring it down to the veterinary clinic, which a lot of our listeners work in. It's sort of looking at, if we can give a real example, whether a dog has a good outcome from an operation, or the other extreme is whether it dies. The individuals might have all the medical knowledge and skills required, but for various reasons, including how the team is structured, or the protocols that they're following, or the equipment they've got, that can affect the outcome as well. Is that the sort of thing you're looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. And although that sort of on the face of it, that sounds like quite an obvious thing to say, doesn't it? That all those things add up to contribute to the outcome. I think sometimes it can be easy to overlook those things, particularly in very science-based professions such as veterinary. But we've seen very similar opportunities to understand this from healthcare, from commercial aviation, from lots of other what they call safety critical professions, where you need to actually take quite a deliberate and quite specific approach to really understand all those different things. Because they can easily be overlooked in these professions where the focus often is technical. And so we know from years, from decades of data from areas such as aviation, that the vast majority of adverse outcomes involving commercial airline, aircraft are primarily linked to something in the field of human factors. So about 75 to 80% of all aviation accidents historically have been primarily linked to something in this field of human factors.
So by that you mean a sort of mistake or a miscommunication or a decision made by a human rather than, a plane having a technical failure. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So in those 75 to 80% of events, they know this from the black box recorders. So this is from the flight data recorders and cockpit voice recorders. We know that in those 75 to 80% of these accidents, there is no indication that anyone involved had a lack of technical knowledge or skill. Generally, pilots know how to fly planes. The air traffic controllers, the cabin crew members, the engineers know what they're doing. The planes are often or almost always working well enough. There might be a problem, but it didn't actually primarily cause the accident. We know that about 75 to 80% of these events are primarily linked to something to do with either communication or teamwork or leadership or decision making. The impact of emotion on people's ability to function if they're feeling fearful or angry or frustrated, and the impact that has on their cognitive functioning, fatigue, hydration, nutrition, people's ability to remember stuff, people's ability to pay attention to stuff, but also the way in which the aircraft and the air environments they're working in are designed in a way that takes all those things into account. Not just simply the technical factors. And when they repeat that same research in areas in healthcare more recently, and in fact, even more recently in veterinary, we start to see the same data. It's not surprising, really, that the same very similar numbers start to come out.
So I was just going to ask that, actually. So you said about 75% of incidents in aviation are due to the human factors. So if we take that down to the veterinary clinic, where you work with teams a lot, if you have a bad outcome, like, for example, a surgery has a hospital-acquired infection, or a patient actually dies under an anesthetic or recovery. Do you find that, at some point, but sort of 80% of those sort of cases are due to, you know, people not understanding the roles properly, or a lack of teamwork, or simply a mistake being made, rather than, you know, equipment failing, or you know, something technical.
Yes, we don't have as much data from the vet profession yet, but the data we do have is showing us a very is showing us exactly that. So actually, Catherine Oxtoby published a paper based looking at errors in veterinary practice in 2015. And this was based around VDS claims. They looked at adverse events that they were unable to gather information from VDS claims. And from that, they concluded that only 14% of the events that they reviewed were primarily linked to what they perceived to be a lack of clinical knowledge or skill. So it did happen, 14%. And then there was a handful of other things around equipment and things. But when you add it all together, you actually get to a very similar number in the region of 80% of these events were primarily linked to something in this field. And it's quite varied, but a lot of them were related to either distraction or stress or sort of process factors around a lot of the things you mentioned there. And we can definitely dig into some of those topics in a bit more detail. But in answer to your question, yes, and that is what we're seeing essentially, that when you start to review these events, it's easy to try and say, well, that event occurred because of human error. When we're talking about human factors, a lot of the time what we're trying to do is break that down a bit more and kind of say, well, what does that really mean? Because trying to say that an adverse event to a patient, or indeed an aviation accident, is primarily because of human error is a bit like saying that people fall over because of gravity.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's not wrong.
Yeah.
You know, often, very often, not always, but very often, adverse or unexpected outcomes do occur because of some form of error or lapse or mistake. Okay. I mean, there's different types of error. You can categorize them in different ways. But
so to try and bring it down to examples people might better identify with. So we've got a dog that's had a surgery, gone home, comes back with an infection, and someone realizes actually it didn't have any antibiotics discharged with it. And the reason for that, when you dig into it, might be because, you know, that you've got a locum vet in, and then the other practices he works in, normally the nurses put up the antibiotics, and that's just what happens. Whereas the nurses or the regular surgeon, they find that the surgeon normally puts them up. And no one did anything different or wrong on that day. There's just a meant that because of the specific team members that were involved and their past experiences and the structures they've worked in before, meant that no one realized that the dog hadn't been given any antibiotics. And that's not a lack of knowledge. Like, everyone knew the dog needed it. It's more of a protocol that's kind of failed, isn't it? Is that the kind of thing you're talking
about? Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really good example, because what you've done there is you've brilliantly explains probably one of the most important underlying principles when we talk about a lot of these things, and that's the complexity of veterinary practice. Veterinary practice is a complex system. One of the lessons that's been learnt when trying to apply concepts from one profession to another is that it doesn't always work perfectly. So if you're trying to apply concepts that have improved efficiency and safety on a car production line, for example, the thing with that is generally a lot of it's quite linear. What happens at one stage is carried on to the next stage. And then if a wheel falls off on stage 13, you can trace it back to probably something that happened at stage 2 when a bolt wasn't put on. And the veterinary practice isn't like that. Veterinary practice has got this web of complexity where you haven't always got a known cause and effect. When you do one thing, you don't know necessarily what the implication of that's going to be. You bring a locum in. Well, that locum in theory has the same level of experience as the person that they're replacing, or possibly more experience. They're very highly regarded. They know exactly what they're doing. They've worked in that practice before. You don't know necessarily the cause and effect of different actions and decisions. So you've got this complexity where you can't always boil it down to saying it was that one protocol. What you can do is say, well, when this event occurs, what are all the different contributing factors? So one of them might be, that at the point at which they prescribed or dispensed medication, they did it in a way unknowingly that was going to mean that the information didn't get to who it needed to get to. Now that could be based upon a protocol, but it could just be based upon the language they use, which is not consistent with what language people in that team normally use. It could also be related to something else that happened at the same time. They could have got distracted in that same moment. There could have been factors around the patient that meant that on that particular occasion, that was exacerbated. You've got this complexity between the interaction between the people, the processes, the equipment, the patient. And so what we need to try and move away from is this idea that we can find a root cause, and more that we have the opportunity to understand the work that people are doing and the environments they're working in. And by doing that, we recognize all the different opportunities we've got to be the best that we can be. And some of that's about learning non-technical skills, you know, the sort of relatively simple factors around how we're asking questions. So, for example, a patient not getting antibiotics, one of the factors could be that someone in amongst that process asked a leading question. And they might have said to someone, oh, they've had their antibiotics, haven't they? And that person was distracted in that moment because of another factor that, that we aren't aware of. And they just say yes, because that's in their mind. It's an easier, you know, that they're not engaging. So because that person's asked a leading question, the person's not really engaged with what they asked them. They just said yes. The person who asked the question got the answer they needed. The patient hasn't actually had the antibiotic. So non-technical skills, you know, are ways in which we learn how to ask questions, how we close the loop on information. And that's one of many factors. What we also might want to consider is the system factors, the processes, the protocols that are in place, whether or not they're fit for purpose, whether or not they actually are appropriate for that environment.
So your sort of role, when you look at teams and practices and sort of organizations, you can kind of, I guess the aim of what you're trying to do with these human factors is set up a situation where if you have a new person arrive or a team member changes, or you have an unexpected situation, like an emergency comes in and distracts everyone, that the process is sort of robust enough that things like discharging with antibiotics won't fall through the cracks. Because how would you achieve that then? Is it making sure that the same person is responsible for checking something? Or I know we talked about checklists before, that kind of thing. Is this how you address the uncertainty within a fluid team? It's not always the same team every day, and they're often dealing with slightly different challenges.
Absolutely. The thing to bear in mind is in environments such as vet practice, it's not as often as simple as saying, this is the solution. You've got X problem across, you know, a problem that a challenge that's faced across many practices across the country, and this is the solution, because it will vary depending on each one. But what we want to try and do is identify what are the moments where the solution is a process. What are the moments where the solution is actually just through developing skills and autonomy within the team? So, for example, there are going to be moments where we just say the best way we can resolve this particular challenge, let's say, is, you know, the point at which we discharge our patients and make sure that they've got the right medications with them. We know that as long as we do A plus B plus C plus D, we're going to get E. So we just need to make sure we've got a process in place that means that regardless of who's working, whether they're a locum, we've just got something that triggered those four things to happen to make sure that that patient's discharged with those medications. So in that environment, that moment, that process, standardization, triggers, prompts, process are absolutely everything. In other moments, it might not be as if we can't have a process for everything. And this is where we've got to be careful not to just cut and paste. We can't say, well, in aviation, that works really well, because the vast majority of moments in aviation are quite predictable. You know, the ways you start engine, the way that you take off, the way you land, like actually most of what you do, if you follow A plus B plus T plus D, you're going to get E 99.9% of the time. So you need to follow
your processes. Just to let everyone know, because you are actually an airline pilot, aren't you? That's your background before you got involved in these patient safety.
Originally that was so I was an airline pilot for about 10 years. I was a flying instructor for a few years before that. And so a lot of the concepts that we talk about have some basis from the world in aviation, but a lot of what we've done is try to understand how a lot of those concepts have then been applied in healthcare. Some of those have gone better than others because of what I'm talking about, because they're not the same environments. And you can take some concepts from aviation and they'll work really, really well, such as a checklist. If you use a checklist before induction of anesthesia, before incision, before surgery, at the end of surgery, and for a few other key things too, it can be used for chemotherapy, it can be used for endoscopy, it can be used for dentistry, it can be used for placements of things like central lines, PICC lines, and chest drains. You can use exactly the same concept that's used on a plane for some things, and they work really, really, really well. We've got to bear in mind there are some moments in veterinary that are not predictable, and we can't make a process for everything. And what we then need to do is think about what are the things that enable teams to support each other, to look out for each other, to speak up if they're not happy, to continuously give each other feedback. And those are the things that enable people to be effective in what we call these ultra adaptive environments, where you don't know what's coming, you've got an emergency that's come in, you don't quite know how they're going to present, you don't know how they're going to react, you don't quite know what condition they've got, you don't quite know what experience level everyone's going to need to deal with the situation, and you're going to need to figure that out, and there isn't going to be a procedure for it.
So there's two things. That's really interesting, the stuff you've touched on there. And I guess, because this is we've only got half an hour or so, if we can touch on two things that you've mentioned there, which I think are really important. One is the checklist, and the other is being able to give feedback in a team. And I guess if we start with checklist, I know I really like the stuff, work that sort of Atul Gawande and people like that have done. There's quite a lot of resistance to checklists from people who aren't used to using them, as it's seen as a box checking exercise, isn't it? And I guess the point of it is it has to be a meaningful implementation that actually adds value rather than just slows down what you're trying to do. Because if you're not using it as a kind of, I don't, you probably know the term for this, but you need to be actively thinking about the checklist rather than just ticking boxes, don't you? Do you have any comments to make on that? If you went to a new practice or that you haven't worked with before and you brought up the concept of checklists, do you find people embrace them or find them frustrating, or they want to use them, or see how
they use them? It's really, really mixed. And exactly the same thing was experienced in healthcare when the World Health Organization did the work, you know, back in 2008, and, you know, followed by which they were implemented quite broadly across, certainly in the UK initially, across healthcare teams. So it's very, very mixed, and there's lots of reasons why people's reactions are different, I suppose, in the same way that our reactions to lots of things are different. But the first thing I try and do is actually try and imagine, well, if someone's, you know, particularly someone who's been doing their job for a long time and doing it to a high standard, why might they find it challenging or irritating or frustrating to be, especially if they're being told by someone else who doesn't do their job frequently, and possibly they don't perceive, knows as much about their job as them. If they're told by that person, they now must use this bit of paper to confirm the things that they know they can do in their sleep. So the first thing to do is kind of empathize and acknowledge why that person or some people in those situations inevitably will find that challenging. And a lot of the best way to manage that is through conversation and through helping to understand what checklists are, where they've come from, why they were found to help. And the story of Atul Gawande, who you mentioned, is so inspiring because this is someone who is an extremely good surgeon, extremely experienced, acknowledged that although he'd never been involved in a major adverse event, he, through his own humility and storytelling, talks about times where it could have happened so many times. It was just through chance that someone else noticed that he was about to do something or had missed something. Mm. And so he recognized that he needed a checklist, not because he didn't know what he was going to do, not because he didn't know that he needed the right patient, that he didn't know he should check what procedure he's going to do. He's going to operate in the right limb, the right part of the body. He doesn't know that he needs sterile equipment or know that he needs to check whether or not antibiotics are needed before a procedure. He recognized that if you do something 1,000 times, because of the complexity of the working environment in surgery and in the moments before and after giving inducing patients for anesthesia, because of the complexity, you can't predict for everything. And if you do it 1,000 times, there are going to be a few where your normal flow of events is going to get interrupted. And things that you know you need to do can get missed. And eventually, if you do something enough times, that moment will be found. And it's luck at that moment, it's luck whether or not someone else happens to notice that it's not been done. And that's what he recognized from his career. Mm. And a checklist is a really good way of mitigating for that. So it's not about, so what it's doing is, and it's hopefully also educating and helping people to understand the evidence base around it, that, you know, when these checklists were introduced, when the World Health Organization did the study in 2008, they did it with 8 hospitals, they did it around the world, they did it over 18 months. And not a single person that I'm aware of who engaged in the study thought it was necessarily a good idea at the beginning, but they were, you know, they were sort of intrigued to see where it went. Almost everyone who engaged in it initially reported to feeling as though it was bureaucratic, it was an extra step, it was a nuisance. But 3 months into the trial, 78% of them found that it had avoided an error being made. 93% of them said if it was them on the operating table, they'd want the checklist to be used.
Yes.
So, and after the 18 months trial, they found that death rates after surgery had dropped by 47%.
Yeah. These are huge, aren't they? I mean, 47%. Put that in context, because we just gave a few stats there, but simply having a checklist reduce death rates by 43%,
47%, 46 point something. Yeah.
So you've almost half as many deaths.
Yeah.
Due to having a checklist, even though everyone was highly skilled and knew what they're doing. It's, I mean, you know, if you're looking at developing new drugs or surgical techniques that could have that level of impact, you'd struggle, wouldn't you? Where something as simple as a checklist, has an impact like that. I mean, it's phenomenal.
It is phenomenal.
I think what surprised me as well is how recent these are. I graduated in 2008. Now I look back, I'm shocked that even the human medical world, which is way ahead of veterinary in most things, didn't even do checklists before they performed complex surgery. No. And I guess from your experience of being in aviation, it must be quite shocking to think that we could have a profession that's been that established for so long that hasn't taken such a simple step to mitigate actual deaths until so recently. I mean, why do you think it took so long to for the medical world to catch up with the aviation world?
I think it's as simple as opportunity. I think aviation had an opportunity. The thing is, when accidents happen involving aircraft, it's very easy for everyone to look at it and go, that shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
The plane was in the sky. It should have landed. Unless it's during wartime and people accept that, yeah, it's very sadly, there are going to be losses and we're not going to investigate every one because that is what happens, sadly. You know, during peacetime, whether it's military or whether it's commercial aviation, the general perception is that planes shouldn't fall out of the sky. So when they do, people want to understand why. And so therefore, black box recorders since the 1970s have provided this unique opportunity in flying to really understand not just what happens, not who did it, but why. And the same thing was true in the 1930s when checklists were introduced, when they had a series of accidents. And it was the B-17, this huge bomber that was made in the 1930s. And they had these accidents. No one was just going, well, it's one of those things, you know, if you fly enough planes, the fuel going to fall out of the sky. They were saying, yeah, well, wait a minute, this shouldn't be happening.
Yeah.
So let's understand why it's happening. And when they found out it was because pilots were forgetting to do a few key steps, it wasn't really possible for Boeing, the manufacturer, to say, well, let's find better pilots. Because they were at the time, they were using the best test pilots available to demonstrate this new aircraft. So it was the first time that a major organization such as Boeing recognized that they had created an aircraft and an environment that was sufficiently complex that if you ask pilots to fly and perform this task enough times, eventually something will happen because their flow of events will get interrupted. They will miss something that they know they need to do. And just telling them to remember and telling them to be careful isn't going to help. So they took this kind of systems approach to saying, okay, well, let's understand what the human limitations are. Let's understand how we can design an environment that means it's easy to do the right thing rather than just telling people to be more careful. So aviation simply had an opportunity since the 1930s. And because of that, it's just been a culture. There's no one flying planes now asks, why do we use checklists? You know, every pilot I'm aware of is very grateful to have something that means that you're less likely to land with the wheels up.
So you don't have the kind of attitude that I've been flying for 20 years, I don't need to fill out a checklist, I know what I'm doing. The fact that it was a completely new industry probably meant they felt there's a lot of scrutiny. And if you can have 200 people die in a plane crash and planes didn't even exist a few years before, suddenly, even from a not only from an ethical and moral point of view, but even from a PR point of view, you need to demonstrate that your industry's safe. Whereas I suppose medicine's been around in some form or another, you know, for many thousands of years. And these sort of things, you know, it wasn't a sudden new invention, was it? You know, and so people didn't have a fresh sort of insight into how to make it safer.
Absolutely. And that's one of the key differences. And it's, as I said, it all comes down to opportunity. Aviation had this opportunity to do things and to normalize certain things, whether it's the use of checklists, whether it's the use of reporting later on, there's all sorts of things that are related to this, whether it's normalizing doing training in non-technical skills, whatever it might be. Aviation had an opportunity to develop an evidence base that demonstrated why it was so important to do these things. And then it just simply had a chance to normalize them. And I think the other thing with healthcare that you mentioned is fascinating is that, there's two things that relate to what I think you said. And one is how long it's been around. And two is the fact that it's always possible to say, well, it was one of those things because healthcare is complex and because patients come in with conditions, animal and human patients come in with, you know, certain conditions and we can't always predict the outcome and we did everything we could. And whereas when a plane falls out of the sky, generally people say, we need to find out why that happened.
Yeah.
So that culture around the willingness to review and investigate without fear of punishment is a huge factor, and it's one I think in this little series that we're doing, Jenny's going to maybe touch on more specifically at another occasion. The other thing I'm fascinated in is this subject of patient safety and the fact that if we go back in healthcare, even 100 years, and you probably know more about the history of healthcare than I do, but like, what could they do if a patient went in to, you know, to see a doctor or went into a hospital 100 years ago? What could they do for them?
It's incredible how much things have changed in the last few years, and I need to check the stats on it, but I remember reading about how it was only after about 1920 that if you went to a sort of standard medical professional, you'd be more likely to get a treatment that helped you than harmed you or did nothing. And that's actually almost, not quite, within living memory, isn't it?
I find that astonishing.
And before that, you could have gone to any sort of quack or anyone who is touting themselves as some sort of healer or selling sort of product, and probably got as good a service as you would going to an actual registered medical trained professional from a and that, you have to caveat that with, you know, there's certain things a medical profession could do really well, certain subjects and injuries, certain that kind of stuff. But when it came to just random treatments, statistically, yeah, they're as likely to harm you as help you. And I think that's,
I find that fascinating.
It's humbling as well, isn't it? How recent interventions have been seen to be useful.
But I think, but also what that tells us, if 100 years ago, so just after the tipping point where hopefully more healthcare was more harm, help, you know, doing more good than it was harm, 100 years ago, still the number of things that could be treated were very low. So the risk of it not going as expected was also very low, because the complexity of what was being done was much lower than it is now. And obviously over the last 100 years, and the same is true for veterinary, that as in not necessarily the same time period, but in terms of development over time, things have just become increasingly more complex. The number of conditions we can treat, which is wonderful, but what it means is that the possibility for it not going as you'd expect it to obviously increases exponentially over time as well. And it's not like we can say that as of the 6th of January on 1952, healthcare is now complex and warrants an understanding of how we can reduce and increase patient safety. It just happened very insidiously. And so what actually happened was, in 1999, in America, they published a paper that you may have heard of called To Err Is Human, or, you know, a publication called To Err Is Human. And in that, it was the sort of first significant study that really put some data around the significance of this kind of idea of avoidable harm in healthcare.
Mm.
And what they concluded at the time was that harm that was occurring to people in healthcare settings was current in at the time in the United States, the third most significant cause of death behind cancer and heart disease. And I think what that made people do is go, whoa.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean that everyone went, oh, wow, everyone that works in healthcare is rubbish at their jobs.
Yeah.
They weren't. They're really, and were and still, you know, are still very good at their jobs. What it demonstrated was that healthcare was now so complex that the possibility of unintended or unexpected outcomes or these adverse events was now just so much higher that it warranted its own area of understanding. And it triggered a whole process that meant that this idea of looking at safety in healthcare in the way that is the way that they do in aviation started to be adopted. Now, the risk with that is that you treat healthcare as if it's, or a hospital as if it's an airline, and it's not. But the mindset around the willingness to understand risk and reduce risk and measure and develop an evidence base, and then from that you develop all sorts of different understandings around how you can train non-technical skills, how you need to manage people's well-being in teams, because not only is that important for them, but it's incredibly important for the outcome of the patients.
You've just touched on something there, Dan, that I was going to mention. We talk a lot about mental health in the veterinary profession, and as a trustee of Vet Life, it's something I do a lot of talks on to students as well. But I suppose, like you said, healthcare is complex, it's multifactorial. You know, sometimes you get the diagnosis right, the treatment right, and the animal might die anyway. And that can really affect some people with their mental health, that they feel that there's more they could have done and they feel very guilty. It's often a misplaced guilt, but it is how they feel. I suppose from a kind of selfish point of view, as a vet or a vet nurse, if you have good protocols and checklists in place and an adverse event occurs, you can be much more comfortable knowing that you've all done your best and you've taken every sort of mitigation, and this hasn't happened because of a silly oversight or avoidable error. It is just, unfortunately, one of those things. You know, it wasn't because the dog was sent home without antibiotics.
Yeah.
It went home with the right antibiotics. It had the right surgery. Sometimes animals die of peritonitis post-surgery despite everything that you've tried to do.
Yeah.
Is that recognized in what you do and in the human world as well, that this is actually helping the mental health of medical practitioners by knowing that?
Yeah, so it's fascinating. The general area of work at the moment that's been coined and discussed explicitly since about the year 2000 is what's known as second victimhood. So the term second victim has one that was originally, as I said, originally started being used about the year 2000 in healthcare as a way of identifying the impact of these adverse outcomes on the people who deliver the care. So of course, now I think there's a lot of discussion to be had around the actual term. So I always like to acknowledge that, because I don't like it to overshadow or cast a shadow over what I think is a really valuable concept. I think the reason that they went for the term second victim is because what they're kind of acknowledging is that what is often who is often considered the person who is primarily affected might be the patient, if that's obviously human or animal, but the patient and possibly the patient's family, but acknowledging that there are also other people that can be adversely affected and often are when these outcomes are not expected. So the second victim, although again we may or may not necessarily agree with the term, is acknowledging that that really does happen, and that they did, and so there's loads of work over the last 20 or just over 20 years now in healthcare to understand the significance of second victimhood, but also how what they've found when people have been affected in this way, this sort of traumatic response to these unexpected outcomes, which don't always involve error. That's what's interesting. Sometimes you have an undesired outcome, but no error was made.
No one did anything wrong. No one did anything.
And sometimes you have a desired outcome where an error was made and people still suffer. So the point, second victimhood relates to both of those situations. And what they found is that there's a whole load of factors around what can reduce the risk that people can be adversely affected by these things. Yeah. But one of them, and one of the most significant ones that often differentiates what they kind of talk about three categories, either kind of dropping out, people that are involved in these events and quit, people that survive, they carry on, but they're affected by it quite adversely, or people that thrive, people that actually have these events and move on positively. And what they found is that when you work in a system, an environment where learning and the ability to improve is prevalent, not only are you, as you've explained already, are you in situations where you can feel as though you're doing everything you can, but you also are in an environment where if something does happen, you are the whatever happens leads to positive change, leads to the development of, so, and again, some people may or may not be aware of the case in healthcare involving a patient called Elaine Bromley, I suppose one of the most well-known events that contributed towards the application of human factors to improve patient safety in healthcare, and that happened in 2005. One of the biggest factors involving the people involved in the delivery of her care, many of whom said that they were going to quit after, very sadly, she passed away, was the fact that such a significant investigation took place, and it led to such a seismic shift in terms of the understanding of these concepts, that was a huge factor in terms of their own recovery, because they were involved in that positive change. And I find that fascinating.
I can identify with that in some ways. That I've written before on the Vet Voices blog about a mistake I made when I was spaying a cat as a new graduate. And I incised a bell, and you know, we tried to rectify it, but 3 weeks later it died of peritonitis, which was probably because of that mistake I made. And you're right, the feeling that maybe I should never do surgery again, or you can even go, maybe I should never be a vet, you know, kind of, but it's also trying to, when it comes to terms, obviously the owners were upset, but I don't think they could have been, well, I was probably equally as upset, you know, with myself and for them and, you know, for the cat. But equally, it's also trying to recognise that I'm now the least likely person to ever incise into a bowel when I do a cat spay. Out of all the people I've ever met, I'm not the best surgeon in the world, but you know, I'm never going to make that mistake again. And if I just quit and never did surgery again, then you sort of feel like that experience had absolutely no positive outcome whatsoever anyway. Yeah. And now I even, you know, when I'm teaching students how to operate, I'm probably the only person who every time says, now make sure before you even start, you don't touch the bowel. Make sure you don't, you know, it's make sure you mitigate against that specific mistake. And so I'm hoping there's a load of other vets now who are less likely to make that mistake simply because I've continued to operate and continued to talk about it and teach that as well. And I guess that's kind of what you're touching on, isn't it?
Yeah, it's such a good example, because anyone who's been involved, and I can relate to this, you know, I've never worked clinically, but I can certainly relate to mistakes I've made where I've been flying, and the interesting thing about flying is because of the nature of the work that we do, it's what's called an ultra safe environment where there are so many layers of safety and most of what you do is quite predictable. So one system can fail, a person can make a mistake at the same time, and it's very unlikely to cause an accident because you've probably got another three or four things that are going to prevent that from filtering through to actually becoming an accident. But I can still have a time where I reflect on something that I did that I feel reduced the safety of that flight and all the passengers, and it's a shock, and it's, so I can relate to that. But what I think is fascinating is that, and so anyone who's been involved in any kind of perceived or real error, because again, there is a difference in perceiving, you know, the perception that you made an error versus actually making an error. This is, and again, another reason why the concept of error is so complex. But the reality is anyone who perceives to have made an error inevitably learns from that experience.
Yes.
The thing that really helps them to recover from that is the knowledge that their experience has benefited others. So when I say others, of course, I mean, like in your situation, other vets, other veterinary professionals, but therefore other patients. Because what you experience means that not only are other people less likely to go through that, but other patients are less likely to be affected in that way. And if it means that we change the system in which we work and we go away from that experience, knowing that we've had that impact, it's a huge factor. But what for that to happen, a lot of the time we need to work in these kind of these learning and what is often referred to as just culture. And actually, it's something that, as I said, Jenny is going to touch upon in a session, a future session as part of this same series. So I won't go into that in too much detail. But you know, so many of these things we're talking about are everything to do with who we are as a species. And they're not very often to do with our technical or clinical skills and abilities. Some of them are, they're related to them, but the opportunity here is to really consciously and deliberately move towards this field of human factors. Because a lot of the concepts that come up within this field that I'm talking about can seem like obvious things. The idea of using a checklist, the idea of asking an open question instead of a leading question, the attending to our well-being in a way that means that we're in the best place we can be to look after our patients. Having an environment of learning and understanding rather than blame, they're often simple concepts. And the problem is because they can seem simple and obvious, they get overlooked. And we just focus all on the technical and the clinical stuff. But the reality is just because these things are simple and seem on the surface to be simple and obvious actually doesn't mean that they're not complex in terms of how we implement them. And that's the thing that I'm fascinated by.
That is fascinating. And the other thing I wanted to go back to was about having everyone feeling able to speak up in a team, because I thought you touched on that before when we talked about checklists, and then we talked about everyone empowering everyone to speak up when they see there's something going wrong. And that is actually a very real problem in a profession where there's quite a hierarchical structure, isn't there? Where you've got like surgeons and you've got nurses and you've got assistants, and in the veterinary world, you've got, you know, receptionists and other sort of healthcare, you know, student nurses, just students seeing practice. Some of them might observe something that's gone wrong or a mistake that's about to happen and feel like it's not their place to speak up, or they're not.
Yeah.
That must be something you've got some insight into.
Yeah, it is. And it's probably the single biggest, other than the sort of some of the other stuff we talked about around designing systems and having, you know, standardizing processes that in certain situations can, you know, make a huge impact. I'd say at a more dynamic level, the thing that can often make the biggest difference in a team is an environment where everyone feels able to speak up. And that generally is multifactorial, but there's two major parts to that. One is, does the environment, is it conducive to them feeling safe to speak up? And are they equipped with the skills and the tools to do it effectively? And those are often the two factors. So one of the things we often talk about is a concept of psychological safety. It's becoming quite a fashionable phrase. There's lots of good reasons, because it is a very important concept. But actually, the underlying elements that contribute towards psychological safety, that sense that people in a team feel safe. And we can all contribute towards this. I think sometimes it feels as though it's only sort of management and senior, you know, very senior members of a team. Everyone can do this. If there's a decision, especially if a vet, you know, is working during a procedure and you've got multiple people in the room at the time, if there's a complication, you know, this concept of asking questions first and leading second. So what is it you, what are the situations where you've got time, rather than just launching in saying this is what we need to do and this is why, just saying, what do you think is going on right now? Because by asking questions first, when there's time to do it, unless it's something that needs an absolutely immediate response, we are allowing people to provide information that may not, they not otherwise provide. And what we're trying to do is not just say to people, it's okay to speak up. We are doing things that show that it's okay to speak up.
Yes.
And when people do speak up, even if we don't agree with them, we are using that information to help us to make a decision. So if you're a decision maker in a team, what are we doing that enables people to contribute information towards us by asking very open questions whenever there's time? And when they provide that information, making sure that we respond to it in a way that says, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought of that. Or actually, yeah, I hear what you're saying. What I think we need to do is this, and this is why. But the point is you're taking that information on, you're engaging in a positive discussion around it, wherever there's time to do so. And we can all do that. We can all demonstrate curiosity. We can all demonstrate what they call kind of confident humility. And these are all skills that we can learn. And then we can also all learn how to raise concerns in an appropriately assertive way. And that's obviously a subject in itself, because what I we don't want to do is, you know,
it's making sure people aren't, you know, for example, if a student realizes that during a surgery something hasn't been flushed, they may not feel they can say to a surgeon, why haven't you flushed it? Or are you going to flush it? Because they feel they might get their head bitten off. You know, they tell me what you're going to do. And I can give an example of that when I was a student of nursing practice as a sixth former. Remember, there's this sheep cesarean happening. And one of the, she wasn't a qualified nurse, but she's sort of working the role of a nurse in this practice. She dropped some stuff from the sterile surgical pack. And she was so scared of the vet, she just put it back on and said to me, like, you know, don't say anything. It signaled that I shouldn't, because he would have gone nuts if she had dropped it. And so, and actually, if that vet realized that he was so sort of terrifying that someone didn't want to admit when something had broken the sterility, he's now using an unsterile tool because she thought she was going to get told off for dropping it. And that's actually a situation where, you know, it's not in any reflection on his skills as a surgeon, but there's a potential affection going to take place. And he won't even know to give antibiotics now because he didn't know sterility would be broken. I guess that's a culture that you've created, isn't it?
And that's that's why I think that's such a good example of what I was saying earlier around the concept of speaking up. Hey, everyone, speak up.
Yeah.
The concept of saying, hey, everyone, make sure everyone around you feels safe to speak up. Those are simple concepts, but actually what was found with an ABA, when they really started to look at examples of black box recorders and they got NASA involved, they got airlines and universities, they spent about a decade in the 1980s researching a lot of this. So it wasn't until the early 90s that a lot of this became a mandatory part of aviation training. After that, it took in the region of 15 years, I would say globally, for the culture in aviation to change significantly. Mm. So that the norm on a cockpit, there was very explicit, deliberate focus, efforts being made, particularly from senior members of teams, like captains, but not only, actually from everybody to an extent, to enable people to feel safe to speak up in often simple ways, in the ways they asked questions, in the way they responded when people did raise concerns, the way that they showed interest in them, made sure they knew their name, all these seemingly simple things. But it's amazing how long it took for the culture to actually shift. And that's what I find so interesting.
Because there's that very famous example, isn't there, of which Mars lander it was that crashed. It's because one team it might have been the Challenger one. No, the Mars, one of the Mars missions, you know, when they're putting landers on.
I can't
think which one it was now, but it turned out that, you know, one team were working in imperial measurements, another were using kilometers instead of feet. And some of the junior engineers had sort of recognized this, but they didn't feel they could bring it up, and they'd sat through meetings where people were discussing different measurements without realizing it. And then, of course, because they didn't feel they could bring it up, that's why, you know, the mission, the satellite or the lander sort of burned up, because they got the wrong trajectory. And it seems fascinating that, you know, at every level, you think you've got a job at NASA, you know, you've hit the top of that point, but there's always someone above you who you feel you can't question, I guess, or has got more experience than you, or you think, well, no one could make this silly mistake, so you don't want to look stupid by bringing it up, do you?
Absolutely. And the fear of humiliation, the fear of being wrong, and a combination of the fear of the repercussions of speaking up if you're wrong, are unbelievably powerful. And again, I know we all know that, but really, just to put this into perspective, there are, and I mean, when I say dozens, I mean dozens of examples of accidents, again, involving aircraft, that have happened where there is evidence from the cockpit voice recorder that a junior member of the team, one of the pilots often, not always, knew exactly what the problem was.
Yeah.
And they just weren't prepared to say it in a way that was going to get that message across. And there are so many examples of this. It is such a powerful fear. And this is the difference in aviation, is that when something's not right, it's their own safety that's at risk as well. It's not just the safety of the patient. It's their own safety.
Their own safety.
Their own life is at risk. And the fear of humiliation, the fear of being wrong, and the fear of repercussion is so strong that these people didn't say anything. And it's not because they weren't good at their jobs. It's not because they weren't confident. It was because at that time, it was not the norm in the profession to make very active steps to help people feel safe. And it wasn't the norm to train people to raise concerns in an appropriately assertive way. And
that's, it's a combination of those two things. When your own life is at risk, the fear of humiliation and being slapped down overrides your own personal safety. I mean, that shows how difficult it would be to speak up in a situation where your own safety is even at risk, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's incredibly powerful. So I would just summarize it in two simple ways. If you are you know, which many people listening will be at some points decision makers in your team, never underestimate how explicit and regular and deliberate it needs to be in terms of at the beginning of procedure, the beginning of days, actually just making a statement around saying something like, if anyone's got any concerns, anything doesn't look right, you know, please let me know, please speak up. If I seem distracted, then, you know, and you think it's critical, then, you know, get my attention, use my name, do saying things that really reiterates it. And then when people do raise concerns, you know, even if you don't agree with them, acknowledge them, help them to understand why you're making the decisions you're making. Get to know people when you don't know them. All these seemingly simple things that flatten the hierarchy. You don't want a flat hierarchy. You need to know who a decision maker is.
Yeah.
But you want everyone to contribute towards those decisions. And if you are someone, if you ever, you need to raise a concern, start by asking questions if you've got time to do it, because very rarely are concerns we're raising actually critical. Sometimes it is. You might be see someone about to administer something that's going to kill a patient or about to cut something they shouldn't, and you literally just need to stop. Yeah. But actually, that's very rare. Usually we can start by saying, what are your thoughts on the patient's sats right now? You know, you're starting to see maybe you're dropping. And rather than saying, why aren't you doing something, or, you know, you need to pay attention or something, you're just saying to them, oh, what do you think? What are your thoughts on so-and-so? And you get that you ask a question that helps them to provide you with information that might well help you to realize that maybe you were on the, you know, had the wrong impression in the first place. Or they might say something that they may say, oh, actually, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that. And you've not undermined them. You've not challenged them. You will if you need to, but you haven't yet, because the vast majority of these kind of differences in perception are resolved by asking an open question that's not inflammatory, that doesn't undermine anyone. So it's a combination of those two factors. You know, if you're in that situation, you need to raise a concern, whenever you've got time, start by asking a question. And it's usually helpful if it's along the lines of, what are your thoughts on? If you're in a decision-making role, take those regular, deliberate, active steps to help people feel safe, and never underestimate how often and how regular and how deliberate that needs to be. Those things together, if multiple people start doing that, the ripple effects, you know, are significant.
And I guess as well, like you've said about, you know, not slapping someone down for raising a query, going back to what we've been repeatedly going back to, you know, if someone notices a dog has been discharged without antibiotics, and it turns out that's because you've done an elective procedure that you don't give antibiotics for, rather than turning around and going, look, you idiot, we don't give them for these, do we? You know,
yeah. So
when the last dog that was discharged did have antibiotics because it had an orthopedic surgery, you know, that you don't want to make a receptionist or someone feel stupid for asking a question, because in their view, they've seen one dog go home with antibiotics, the next one without, and they've flagged it up. And they're not to know that it's a different procedure. I guess it's having that sort of culture where people aren't going to feel stupid for querying why, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And there's so many different ways of responding to that, isn't there? You can say the same thing in so many different ways. There's a big difference in saying, yeah, and, you know, even just bluntly saying, no, we don't do that here. It's very different than saying, you know, it's really interesting, actually. Can I ask out of interest why, you know, why you perceive that to be necessary? And it might be that they say, oh, in my last practice X, Y, and Z or whatever, and you can have a discussion about it, and saying what we found is, and you can just explain. And it might be that you learn something you just never expect to learn in that conversation, even if it turns out that you don't change what you do. But the point is, it's become a conversation, and that person hopefully feels included in that process, and at least one of you may learn something. It's fascinating, the subtleties around language. And one of the things that we're involved at the moment is training to myself and another one of our team, Jess, we are becoming trainers in the field of what's called nonviolent communication. And this is a way of communicating in very, very specific ways that has been found to essentially trigger a far more positive response in terms of, you know, how people receive feedback, in terms of how we can demonstrate that we have heard what someone is saying. And it was all based around the mediation of civil rights groups in the 1960s in America, some of the most difficult conversations that were had. And I find it utterly fascinating, the subtlety of language and how we can really shape the difference in someone's experience, and therefore their willingness to speak up, and therefore the safety of our patients, just by the difference, you know, changing a few words.
That's really interesting. And also, I guess, I know from personal experience, having to justify your decision sometimes actually makes you change your decision, doesn't it? Somebody actually have to say it out loud, why you're doing something or not doing it. So, you know, it's a very healthy thing to do, to better justify your decision-making. Dan, that's been really interesting. And we could probably do a 5-hour discussion on this. I'd definitely love to talk to you again about another specific human factor. We'll share the links to VetLed in your post with this podcast as well. And if we have any questions come in, we'll send them to you as well, because people might have some questions about what we've discussed. But thank you for your time on this. I think it's probably something that every practice should be consciously thinking about, and looking at not only patient safety, but like you said before, mental health as well. I think the two are quite closely linked. And everything you've said has shown that you can be the best vet in the world, the best vet nurse in the world, and still have, you know, undesirable outcomes. And if you can firstly avoid them, or secondly, not feel bad about them because you know you've done everything possible, then I think, you know, it shows how important these interventions are. So now, thank you for your time and thank you for your experience. And we will chat to you again about this.